Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug-Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug-Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a violent conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Violent as in the injury or death caused by physical force. Drugs and alcohol are known to be associated with violence. People generally are aware of the violence associated with alcohol and methamphetamine. They're less aware of violence associated with plain old marijuana. Yet there are a growing number of cases and studies showing just that. We talked on this show with Bryn Spacer, who, under a state of cannabis-induced psychosis, stabbed her boyfriend 108 times, killing him and nearly killing herself. The problem is lack of data. Medical examiners and coroners are not reporting toxicology results in a standardized way. A disturbing case is President Donald J. Trump's shooter. Thomas Crook died of a gunshot wound to the head from Secret Service sniper after firing at the president and injuring innocent people at a Trump rally. The killer's toxicology report was read as negative for alcohol or drugs and an elevated blood lead level of 5.9 micrograms per deciliter. However, the toxicology did not include THC, the active ingredient of marijuana, or the various intoxicating hemp products. It did include buprenorphine, cocaine, fentanyl, amphetamine, carisoprodol. What's with the lead? Finding lead in an otherwise healthy young man is a telltale sign of chronic marijuana use. The bottom line is that the President of the United States killer received an incomplete autopsy. To learn more about violence and marijuana killers, I reached out to Dr. Ken Finn. Dr. Ken Finn is a medical doctor practicing pain medicine, previously in Colorado Springs and now in Prescott, Arizona. He's board certified in physical medicine and rehabilitation, pain medicine, and pain management. He's a former president of the American Board of Pain Medicine. Dr. Finn is editor of the first medical textbook of Cannabis and Medicine, an Evidence-Based Approach, and vice president of the International Academy on the Science and Impacts of Cannabis. He is one of our nation's most important experts in marijuana, giving scientific testimony nationally and internationally. To learn more about Dr. Ken Finn, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Dr. Finn on July 11th, 2025. Dr. Finn, Ken Finn, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
And yeah, so, our producer Dave reminded me that you get like the gold star for being on the High Truths more than any other guest. I try to not to have repeat, but you've coming back at our season finale and giving us perspective. So it is, but there's always more to talk about. So it's great to have you on.
Thank you so much. Always good seeing you again.
Let's start, even though you've been here before, but just to a little background, you're a pain physician and why do you care so much about the impacts of marijuana?
Well, this was not my career choice. I think neither of us or any of us that are involved in this in the medical profession planned on knowing as much as we do in marijuana space. So as a pain physician, I practiced in Colorado for nearly 30 years and recently moved to Arizona to continue practicing pain medicine. But the reason I went down this pathway is as a pain physician, being in Colorado, we voted to legalize marijuana for medical purposes in 2000, shortly after California did in 1996. And we implemented our program in 2001. And the program was somewhat dormant for many years. because there was no infrastructure, there were no dispensaries. I think physicians were fearful of making recommendations and fear prosecution or litigation against their license. So it just kind of sat there for many years. But in 2009, I believe it was after the Ogden memo passed, there was a lot of politicking in the state of Colorado, and suddenly the dispensaries bloomed across the state. To even to this day, there's more marijuana dispensaries than McDonald's and Starbucks combined, like in other states. So patients at that point started coming to me because I'm a referral-based practice, and they were taking enormous amount of opioids, which is a whole other discussion we can have regarding our opioid crisis. They were reporting very high levels of pain, and they were using marijuana. So clinically, it didn't make any sense to me as to what the story was behind, you know, marijuana and its use in pain, because that was one of the platforms to legalize. Was we're in the midst of this opioid epidemic, and marijuana is supposed to be this awesome analgesic or opioid substitute, and it's going to solve our opioid crisis. And from a clinical perspective, that didn't appear to be the case, because patients were coming to me on high doses of opioids and using marijuana, and when I would pin them down and I would ask them, and I say, well, okay, well, let's taper your opioids and you can use as much marijuana as you want. I can tell you 99% of my patients said, I didn't want to do that. And I asked them, well, why is that? They said, because it doesn't help my pain. And so that, to me, was kind of a starting point of this journey of mine going down and learning more about cannabinoids, endocannabinoid system, the interaction between cannabinoids and opioids. And then my clinical experience began because I started talking more to my colleagues in the state of Colorado and other states where I do a lot of public speaking. And everybody's clinical experience has been the same, that it doesn't appear to be a good opioid substitute or a sufficient analgesic. So the next thing I know, after researching, I ended up on the Colorado Governor's Task Force, Amendment 64. When we legalized for recreational purposes, I served on the Consumer Safety and Social Issues Work Group. I served on the state's Medical Marijuana Scientific Advisory Council for several years, and then began this public speaking journey. And Ronit can relate to this.
And you wrote a book.
And I edited a medical textbook with 70 authors, 4 countries, 20 chapters, and a year and a half of my life I'll never get back. And so I have a much higher regard for people that edit. I'm entertaining the idea, although it terrifies me, of a volume 2. And I think because the data does change, it evolves all the time. But at the same breath, I think you had mentioned earlier on our conversation, is that the data really isn't, it hasn't changed. It's pretty much the same. The harms have been noted for decades. For example, I don't know if you've ever read Peggy Mann's book, Pot Safari, from 1982. She was a journalist. She wasn't even a physician or researcher or scientist, but she went around the country looking and talking to all the marijuana researchers of the time and published this book as a journalist. And everything in her book was in my medical textbook. So these things have been known for many, many years. They even predates Peggy Mann. And by the way, she just had her daughter, who lives in Swiss Normandy, France, just reprinted her mom's work in a reprint version of the same book. Same, you know, didn't change anything in terms of the text, but was gracious enough to ask me to write the foreword. And our former drug czar, Bob DuPont, also contributed to the reprint of Peggy's book, and he contributed to her original book. So that's the reason I ended up down this road, you know, co-founding ISAC, the International Academy of the Science and Impacts of Cannabis. And as you know, we do a lot of work internationally, speaking on the public health and safety concerns we have as physicians and scientists on the use of another addictive substance.
Yeah. And so what you're seeing now, several things about, you know, it's important to notice about your clinical practices. As a pain physician, you had people who were on marijuana thinking it was for pain, and you're saying, okay, use that, but it really didn't help their pain. It didn't decrease the number of opiates or the milligrams of pain medicines that they needed.
No, I think I've had maybe less than a handful of patients that got off of their opioids and continued to use their marijuana. But that was very, very few. But interestingly, and this is very consistent with the literature on experimental pain models, even though they got off their opioids and continued to use their marijuana, their levels of pain, their numeric pain scale never changed. So it really doesn't do anything in terms of reducing the level of pain they have, their pain intensity. And that has been demonstrated in animal models on cannabis. It might a very sliver reduction in their pain score, but nothing significant to say, well, my pain went from an 8 to a 2 using marijuana. That doesn't seem to be the case. It may have gone from an 8 to a 7 or just remained an 8. It has been my clinical experience. It didn't change their pain, high levels of pain.
Yeah. Now, you and I got into this whole business because of the opioid prescription epidemic, where we were the suppliers of the drugs that people were dying from, and parents were very angry. And I think we've ended that crisis with safe prescribing. We certainly don't see that kind of, well, not zero, but nothing like we had as terms of people wanting refills of their pain meds in the emergency department. I'm wondering, as a pain physician, do you see that improvement as well?
Oh, of course. I think, you know, the opioid crisis is very complex. You know, you have, and things have changed. And I think the recent CDC data is showing a nice trend on the decline of opioid prescribing, opioid drug overdose deaths in general, because all these substances tend to play very well in the sandbox. So as more states went down this road of legalization, we saw an increase, not a decrease, in state-by-state drug overdose deaths. So that included prescription opioids, the fentanyl epidemic became a scourge, but other things like stimulants, like cocaine, methamphetamine, those overdose deaths also continued to rise under this banner of legalization. So for many, many years,
That was really, to be fair, that's because of the fentanyl. That's been driving that logarithmic elevation in deaths.
Well, the logarithmic elevation in deaths is definitely driven by fentanyl, but it seemed to start after many states started legalizing marijuana for both medical and recreational purposes. Actually, myself, Archie Blyer, who's a physician, a former pediatric radiation oncologist from MD Anderson, he did a lot of the heavy lifting, but he and I and his colleague Brian Barnes published several papers showing that fentanyl death rates were higher in marijuana states that legalized compared to those states that did not legalize marijuana. So what is that connection there, where those states, and over time, got worse and worse and worse? So more states were legalizing for medical and recreational purposes, and our fentanyl crisis worsened in those states compared to the states that did not.
It would make sense physiologically, because if you have more of a population using drugs, marijuana, whatever, then your dopamine need becomes bumped up and you're more likely to start using other drugs.
Well, I think it goes deeper than that, just because I've done a lot of reading and research on this intricate relationship between the endocannabinoid and the opioid systems. They come from the same type of receptor, the G-coupled protein receptors. They're in that same family. They co-localize in the same area of the nerve endings that modulate neurotransmission in the GABA internergic neurons. So they have this relationship that is very complex. For example, the number one predictor for an adolescent to misuse opioids was having ever used marijuana in their lifetime. That was based on youth risk behavior survey data from 2019-2020. There was another study showing that the number one predictor for an adult to misuse opioids was having used marijuana before the age of 18. That was, you know, there's other confounding factors, but those were the number one predictors of an adolescent or an adult to misuse opioids. And interestingly, Mark Olson published a nice paper in 2018, I believe it was, showing that cannabis users, you know, regular daily, near daily users, were more likely to misuse opioids 3 years later. So there's this very tight relationship between the opioid and cannabinoid systems in the human body, especially when you're throwing exogenous cannabinoids or exogenous opioids at the human body. What happens? I mean, they modulate very similar neural pathways, and there is evidence from a molecular level on the pain-relieving qualities of cannabinoids. So they do provide some level of analgesia from a molecular perspective, but when you translate that into real world data with dispensary marijuana, it just falls flat because all these states that went down this road, their drug deaths continue to rise, fueled, like you mentioned, with fentanyl, but also fueled by increases in stimulants like methamphetamine and cocaine. And the Colorado data, interestingly, shows a gradual rise on our annual overdose death reports of the mentions of cannabis in our deaths. I think it's probably a companion drug or possibly a synthetic cannabinoid, which I think is not as prevalent. But why is that? Why is that happening in these states? And Colorado is the only state that I know of that's actually looking at that data. The problem that we run into is that getting the data from the medical examiner and coroners has been very tricky because sometimes they don't test for it, they don't look. It just seems to be present on some things. There's no national guidelines for testing in these drug overdose deaths. So I think, like I mentioned earlier, these drugs all play very well in the sandbox. And I think the fentanyls have really replaced heroin because the heroin overdoses are on the decline in most states because even as readily available and cheap as it is, fentanyl is the driving force. And now we have the other drugs like nitrazines and beyond that are causing a lot of harm. But if you circle back to this opioid cannabinoid relationship, I think the relationship is very tight. And I don't have a good answer as to why that's happening. I can just base it on what the medical literature says at this point in time.
Interesting. So I wanted to have an episode talking about the violence. And I know that that's been a passionate subject for you. What is the association between THC and violence?
You know, this was not a path or rabbit hole that I really intended to go down. I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a practicing psychiatrist. But having researched and looked into cannabis from a variety of health effects, from the brain being the number one target organ to the heart being the number two target organ, and then beyond into, you know, child poisonings, geriatric poisonings, you know, hospital care utilization, healthcare costs, et cetera. This violence thing just always seemed to come up as a common denominator in a lot of these cases that we're seeing now. And I don't know what the answer is, because psychosis is a very complex diagnosis. Violence is a very complex diagnosis, a lot of factors. But having done a lot of research down this pathway, what I'm finding is that a lot of crimes, some of them are very horrific, have marijuana at the dance. It seems to be that girl at the dance. She's there every single dance, but nobody's acknowledging the fact that she's there. But she's there every single time. Nobody asked her to dance, but she's there in her little ponytails and bow.
Man, Ken, you remind me of my childhood. I was that girl that nobody asked to dance.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's too bad. I'd ask you to dance, Renee. Although I wouldn't say that in front of my wife.
I was this geeky little thing, you know.
Well, I'm not a good dancer anyway. You don't want to see that for sure. Anyhow, but like Ian David Long, perfect example from Thousand Oaks, California, was a mass shooter. And he killed 12 people, including an off-duty officer. And I've tracked down his toxicology, and there's THC in his system. There were no other substances like opioids or stimulants in his system, and THC is there.
So I want to talk about what this thing that you're doing, because I want to emphasize it. I did a podcast with Lori Jane Gleehan, and she's an investigative reporter who looked at over 400 pediatric deaths with fentanyl. And it reminds me kind of what you're doing. We're just like case a case all over the country. And she created this Excel file and toxicology reports and video camera. And she's done a whole series about babies and children who've died of fentanyl. And you're kind of doing the same kind of investigative reporting of violent deaths, crazy stories where THC has been in the system or not tested for at all. So with that premise, I want to hear these specific, some of, you know, we have too many to like review all here, but give us like more details about some of these cases.
Well, that's kind of, and again, I don't know why I'm going down this. It's almost the, I talked to a Wall Street Journal person several months ago, and we had several conversations and emails back and forth. And she talked to me about a month or so ago. She said, you know what? Now that I see it, I can't unsee it. Because a lot of these things kind of go under the radar. There's like a mass shooting or a violent act, and then something else in the news happens. But anytime there's a weird, violent crime, I try to find out the story behind. And I don't know why I do this. I just find it so fascinating, interesting that these cases.
And weird cases, right? Somebody like ate someone's face off or decapitated weird. His dad's head and showed it on YouTube. Like weird, weird things, right?
Yeah. Those are like the extreme cases, but even like the mass shootings, like the one I mentioned in Thousand Oaks, California, Ian David Long was positive for THC.
Tell us about Ian David Long. He was the shooter who...
He was a mass shooter in Thousand Oaks, California several years ago who shot and killed 12 people at a bar in California, Thousand Oaks. And, you know, one was an off-duty police officer and, you know, he went on this rampage. And I got his toxicology report, and there was only THC in the system. There was no other stimulants, PCP, methamphetamine, cocaine that you would probably gravitate to as somebody going off the rails.
Do you think that this is, people read stories like that and think, well, this is just some crazy guy?
Well, that's exactly it, because, you know, I want to be very clear. Not everybody that uses is going to become a homicidal maniac. But the fact is that we are starting to see an increase. I think we're just paying attention more, perhaps, or it's becoming more prevalent, or the potencies may have a factor to do with this. But a lot of these crimes, like Ian David Long, seem to circulate around THC, that girl with the dance. She seems to be there very often. Kevin Neal from Northern California, who was actually a marijuana grower, didn't like his wife and shot her and stuffed her in a hole under their mobile home. Shot and killed a couple of his neighbors and then went driving to shoot up a school, but was intercepted by law enforcement. And I have his toxicology, and he only had THC in the system. So after a couple of those, I started trying to pay attention more to some of these news stories, these weird ones. Justin Moen from Pennsylvania, who was going in, I think his trial just started this week, who gave up his medical marijuana card 2 weeks prior to purchasing a gun, because that was the window. And we know cannabis psychosis can persist for weeks or even months, or in some rare instances, never reverse. And then he shot his father in the head, cut his father's head off, and then posted a rant of political views on YouTube with his father's decapitated head in full view of everybody watching. We have examples of people that, I think there was a gentleman, Colby Parker from North Carolina, killed his grandfather, chopped his ears off, and then handed his grandpa's ears to the law enforcement people. So we have these weird, very extreme cases. Blair Ness, who stabbed a 16-month-old baby, Ashton, to death in the middle of the day in Dallas. I have his toxicology report, and it was only positive for THC. Richard Kirk, who shot his wife, Christine, in the head in front of their children when she was on 911 trying to get him help because he became acutely psychotic after eating a bunch of edibles in Colorado shortly after we legalized. He's serving 30 years in prison for murder, and he was only positive for THC. Brent Spetcher, as you know, is the most notarized.
She was just on our podcast, and you could see her that she is, you know, today, and we could hear her story that before using marijuana just one time was normal. If you see her and hear her story, she's not like, you know, a crazy maniac. And used marijuana before, but this one time she got a psychotic episode.
Right. And psychosis is a very complex diagnosis. And I think you were at a conference that I was speaking at where somebody was talking about, oh, it's their adverse childhood experiences that really precipitated their psychotic event. And again, psychosis is a complex diagnosis. There's genetic predisposition, environmental factors, adverse childhood experiences, et cetera. But when there is a temporal relationship between use and violent act, you know, is the marijuana kind of a catalyst that precipitates this violence in some people without any good predictors? That's what makes it very difficult. And my understanding when Bryn, who was had used, my understanding she's used before but was not a regular user, took a hit off a bomb that her friend Chad did something called stacking. And I don't know if she mentioned stacking where he would fill the bong but not inhale the smoke and fill it several times, where inside the bong was a very thick, dense smoke of multiple bowls. And that's when she took a hit and became acutely psychotic. And although I don't have her toxicology report, I do have his toxicology report. And there was only THC in his toxicology. And the folks I know that were close to the trial that went on pretty much every day said that she had also been noted to have only THC in her system and nothing else.
Yeah. And they also tested the bong to see that that had THC in it and nothing else.
Right. So this whole, these, all these violent acts, I mean, it's kind of to the point for me.
I wonder some of these killers that that weren't killed by police or that are sitting in jail, if anybody interviewed them and seeing if they still have psychosis or they're like, wow, I don't know what happened to me.
That's a really good question. I don't know. I think that several of the folks, like Richard Kirk, for example, has, you know, remorse for killing his wife in front of their children, and she's dead. He's in jail, and the kids don't have parents really anymore. I don't think, my guess would be that they're no longer psychotic, but you have other people like Robert Deer, who was the Planned Parenthood shooter in Colorado Springs several years ago, who continues to remain, quote, incompetent to stand trial, but moved from the Carolinas to Colorado to smoke marijuana. He advertised on Craigslist to find people to smoke with. His girlfriend had a medical marijuana card, and he shot up and killed three people in Colorado Springs and is still in jail, but still hasn't gone to trial because he's still, quote, incompetent. So he may have persistent psychosis. And I've tried every angle to track down his toxicology, but since it's still a, quote, ongoing investigation, we may never know. The Boulder supermarket shooter. I listened to the entire court transcript. I mean,
tell us a little bit more about the story so we get to know what happened at the supermarket.
The Boulder, there was a gentleman in Boulder, Colorado, who went to a King Supers or City Market supermarket and shot and killed, I don't know how many people, but I think more than a dozen people were killed. And he went to jail. He was still incompetent. I think that's still an ongoing investigation. Let me rewind. I believe he was recently sentenced to jail. And I don't know if it was a reason by insanity plea or whatever happened in jail, but we did listen to those transcripts in the court. And interestingly, and these are like kind of the smoking guns that make me wonder, is in the court transcript, his brother on the stand had mentioned the morning of the shooting, he was talking in gibberish, very incomprehensible, and mentioned marijuana use in there. And the prosecuting attorney and the defense attorney didn't even bite off on it, didn't even go down that road. And we tried to find out whether or not he was tested. And what I've learned to, this is why I think, you know, you and I have had this discussion about drug testing mandates. So if a perpetrator commits a crime and the police show up and they go directly to jail, they don't do any testing. If the perpetrator is maimed or killed, if they're maimed, they go to the hospital and they typically will do kind of a medical workup and that may include toxicology. Or if they're killed, it tends to be easier to get the toxicology report. In some/most cases, a good example is the Uvalde shooter in Texas. We've been trying to
tell us about that case, that story then.
Yeah, if those that may not know, there was a young man in Uvalde, Texas, who's kind of rural Texas outside of San Antonio, who one morning shot and killed children, many children in Uvalde, Texas. And he was shot and killed by police. And we still cannot get the toxicology on him. He was a known marijuana user. There were some mentions of his grandmother throwing, kicking him out of the house because she refused to have him smoking marijuana in the house. And I believe she was one of the first people he killed before he shot up and killed a bunch of children at a school. But for some reason, we cannot get that toxicology, which is somewhat atypical. Usually in most states, if somebody is killed, and they do an autopsy, they typically will run drug testing in most cases. We found some examples in other states where they just don't test, which I found unusual. But this particular case in Uvalde, we're trying to figure out whether or not there was drug testing done. I did speak to the judge slash coroner in Bashar County, who in Uvalde, he's the judge and the coroner. He verbally told me that he has seen a toxicology report, but it still remains a mystery as to if it's there and if what it said.
There's a lot of inconsistencies. Things are not standardized. And I think an example of that is our own president's shooter, President Donald J. Trump, attempted assassination in Butler County, Pennsylvania. The shooter that shot him in the ear and killed a firefighter, they did toxicology on him, and it was incomplete. Tell us about that. You were able to see the results.
Correct. I found it interesting. And I don't know how it was kind of happenstance how I ended up going in the road with the Trump shooter. Just, you know, when you hear and read and have dug into a lot of cases and shootings and you find THC, I think there was a point in time about 6 months ago, I kind of questioned, you know, the shooter who was a 20-year-old man.
Young men. You know, with mass shooting, there's a correlation there, right? I mean, it's not cause and effect, right? There's a lot of nice young men.
Of course.
Right? And, but it's a pattern.
And he wasn't a mass shooter, although he could have been. I mean, he was an assassin who inadvertently killed.
He wanted to be. He was just stopped before he got to be.
Correct. But I think his primary target, he missed the mark and killed an American hero, a firefighter. But when I looked into this particular case, I was able to get the toxicology report from the Allegheny Medical Examiner. And the interesting thing, which was unusual, is they did a heavy metal screen. And he did have elevated levels of lead in his system, which to me would be very unusual for a 20-year-old man. The medical literature does support that heavy metals like lead and cadmium are higher in blood and urine in chronic marijuana users. So I try to connect that dot. And when I got the full toxicology report, the Allegheny Medical Examiner didn't test for cannabinoids, which I found very suspect because on their own website, they talked about how wonderful they are in doing 6,000 toxicology reports a year, looking at things like fentanyl, other stimulants, and cannabis sativa on their website, and they didn't even test for it. And I don't know, was that willful neglect?
So they're like testing for lead and cadmium and buprenorphine and carisoprodol, and they have all these tests, but they specifically don't have THC.
Correct, despite the fact on their own website, they say they tested 6,000 cases in a year, and most of them show opioids and cannabis. Which is so? What's the why'd they miss the mark? So I tried to call them and ask them to retest the samples because they actually retain blood, urine, and hair, which is very uncommon. I rarely see hair samples taken and tested, but they will be destroying that evidence, potential evidence, probably tomorrow. July 12, 2025, because they only are required to keep those samples for 1 year. And I've been having a very difficult time trying to get anybody to ask them. I've asked them myself several times to retest the samples and provide toxicology results, and they have refused to do that.
I think that's crazy.
At the end of the day, if they test it and there's nothing there, fine, I don't care. But at least if it was a family or loved one, I would want every stone unturned. You know, they didn't even test for antidepressants, which we know can cause.
But it's suboptimal care and a suboptimal investigation of someone who tried to kill the president of the United States.
Correct.
And it's not that he's special. There's a substandard, you know, Matthew Perry, right? He died right. Of a ketamine overdose and his toxicology. And I think you sent it to me and I was able to read the autopsy report was also associated with buprenorphine, a medication to treat opiate use disorder. And they said, well, the reason they included buprenorphine and Matthew Perry's death. And Matthew Perry is the famous actor of Friends, and was because it was association that buprenorphine and ketamine, they act together. Well, THC and buprenorphine, or THC and ketamine, also act together. But that out of their panel, they specifically did not include that. And if you ask them why they don't include it, it's like, well, nobody ever dies of it. But if you don't check, then how are you going to know?
And I think I sent you another case, Elijah McClain, that was a very politicized, tragic murder and shooting of a young man in Aurora, Colorado, who got I think I sent you all the toxicology, died by what the coroner said was a ketamine overdose. But we all know that the dose of ketamine in his system was subtherapeutic, number one, and not a lethal dose. And Elijah McClain, I think it's such a tragic story. I don't know if you remember.
Tell us the story.
Yeah, he was a young man, African-American, kind of minding his own business, walking in a neighborhood. Somebody thought that he was, you know, robbing a house or going into a house under construction or something in that effect. And somebody called the cops on him. The cops came. One thing led to another, and this poor young man ended up dying. He was became violent, was injected with ketamine, and then died. It was just a tragedy. I feel so bad for the family. Never should have happened.
He died by police.
Died by police. And his toxicology, he had marijuana in his system. And, you know, I did a lot of research, and I pinged you. I said, well, this is his ketamine level. He didn't overdose on ketamine. You know, it was a sublethal dose of ketamine in this young man's system. But he also had marijuana in his system. And we know the association between marijuana and violence and psychosis and these violent acts. And I don't think he became psychotic. I think it was kind of a perfect storm, because there's a drug interaction between THC and ketamine. And they said he died from a heart attack because he kind of was ramped up. I don't know if they use the term excited delirium anymore, or if they use something different. But it kind of was the perfect storm in this young man. And I don't think he should have died. But they're blaming the police and they're blaming a ketamine overdose, and they completely ignore the fact that THC was in his system. And we know that THC can cause those very same.
Wait, was he shot by police when he was violent towards them?
He was not shot. He was, I don't know if he was in a choke. He wasn't suffocated. I think he just got so ramped up, he ended up having a heart attack.
You know, we see those patients in the emergency department on a regular basis from all sorts of drugs. And they're very scary because they could die on us. We give them more medications to sedate them, but they could still die. I think that those are they're violent and very scary cases. And he just died outside the hospital with police around, but we see those patients in the emergency department regularly.
Well, that's the interesting thing, because I don't want to go detract too much, but the evidence in the cardiovascular literature is showing that regular users of cannabis, even at younger ages, like in 30s and 40s, are now showing coronary artery disease. And that was never used to be the case. I mean, you're old enough to know, but in an emergency department, coronary artery disease was historically a disease of 50, 60, and 70-year-olds, not 30 and 40-year-olds. And we're now showing that people that are using marijuana on a regular basis are starting to show changes in their cardiovascular system and have coronary artery disease. We actually had a very nice speaker at ISAC, Dr. Mark Chandy, who's now one of our advisors, give a very nice overview on the cardiovascular effects of cannabis use. I think it was very well done. But that's another thing that physicians even don't realize. They don't realize this link. And that's why you and I continue to do what we do, is mainly to educate our colleagues. So if our colleagues don't know, how does the general public know or law enforcement know? They don't. That's why we keep getting asked back time and time again to talk to places like UCLA that I spoke at for the third time a couple months ago, MD Anderson Cancer Center. I give grand rounds all the time. And every time that you and I talk to our colleagues, you always get deer in the headlights and said, I had no idea. Like CBD, for example, has almost 620 drug interactions. And that's something that's not going to get people stoned. But I have these conversations with my patients in the office saying, well, little lady with osteoarthritis on meloxicam wants to use CBD pills. And I say, well, let's go to drugs.com and look at cannabidiol and the interaction between CBD and meloxicam. And there's a moderate interaction for liver disease, liver damage. So those are the conversations our colleagues really don't know about.
Right. And it's very, very important.
Right.
You know, I did have a patient, remind me of one of my patient stories, who came in and who had that same agitated delirium, or whatever the politically correct word is to use now, of being ramped up on drugs with your blood pressure going up, heart rate going up, and really violent behavior, where you have a spit sock on them and you know, six burly guys restraining them while, you know, right. I, as the emergency physician, come and, you know, give medications to calm the situation. And when this guy, and he was all beat up, you know, scratched up like he was a fight. And he actually woke up during my shift, which is rare, because usually these people have to take a long time. And I asked him, like, what happened? And he said he was in an apartment by himself and he had a gummy bear, right? And I'm like, how many gummy bears did you have? And he said, I just had one.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, it might be a big guy needs one, or a small woman needs five.
Or that one gummy bear had all the THC and the other gummy bears had all sugar in it, because there's no, they don't mix them up, you know, in a scientific way.
And it's interesting you bring that particular case up, because I have another colleague friend of mine who's a hospitalist in South Carolina. He knows how involved I am in these marijuana cases. And he had a patient who was just amped up and they didn't know what it was. And it was only THC in his system. And he had rhabdomyolysis, which is a breakdown of muscle tissue. And
his test all those patients for rhabdo because of all that agitation.
Agitation.
I check a CK in all those patients.
His CK was like 33,000.
Yeah.
You know, and that could be deadly. And people say, well, people never die from marijuana. Well, you're not going to stop breathing from marijuana, which is, everybody knows that. But people can die from marijuana indirectly. They may have rhabdomyolysis and renal failure and then die. They may have hyperemesis and electrolyte abnormalities and then end up with an arrhythmia and die.
Or had a psychotic episode and think that they can jump and fly or be violent. Or
suicide. You know, there's all these little pathways that you can go down, all circulating about marijuana. And that's why I ended up down this road of this link, this association between cannabis use and violence and psychosis, because they kind of go hand in hand. And so we know there's a link there. Now, we always get yelled at, well, correlation doesn't equal causation. Well, no, it doesn't. But what's the tipping point going to be when we have the body count of X, when people start to say, well, maybe there's really something there? And there's this big debate on whether or not cannabis causes psychosis, but cannabis has the highest conversion to psychosis and bipolar than any other substance, including stimulants.
Methamphetamine, yeah.
And methamphetamine and cocaine. I mean, almost 47, 48% can convert to psychosis. But what's the pathway? We don't really understand the pathway fully because it's very complex. There's other factors that may be going into it. So this is just my personal opinion. You may agree or disagree, or other people may disagree with me. But I think cannabis really serves as a catalyst to these things where people are using and then they suddenly become psychotic. But is it causing it or is it precipitating it?
Right. Or both. And I think that the data, and by data, I mean like 7 million people in Canada where they've really looked at the data, shows that causation too, not just correlation, when you have such, you know, such numbers.
Well, one of our advisors published a very nice paper using the Bradford Hill criteria. And they used the Bradford Hill criteria has been around for many, many years. And it was the criteria that linked the causal relationship between tobacco and lung cancer. And there's certain criteria for that. And one of our advisors from Denmark used the same criteria. And using that criteria, he was able to prove a causal relationship between cannabis use and psychosis.
Right. And the Bradford Hill was used with tobacco when nobody thought that tobacco is, right. You know, is causing those black lungs. They had to, you know, like, well, that's just by chance. And they were used that in order to show that effect.
Well, it's interesting you bring up lung cancer. I'm going to interject here for a second because, you know, the Pilgrims used a lot of tobacco, right? Mm-hmm. And there were probably some cases of lung cancer back in the 1600s. But, you know, lung cancer did not become a problem, a big problem, or public health problem until mass commercialization and marketing of cigarettes. You know, doctors prefer Camels and dentists prefer Viceroys. All the marketing, the commercials, the vending machines, all that commercialization. And now in the world of marijuana, we're seeing the same thing with commercialization, mass production. We're starting to now see the public health implications.
Right. Now, with the violence, do you think it's really because of the dosage? I'm thinking of Brynn's case. She's used marijuana a few times before, and not become psychotic. But when she had that stacking increase dose, that did happen to her. Do you think a lot of these cases that we're seeing is it's dose related?
Absolutely. I think that the medical literature is very clear on potency. I mean, the European data considers anything more than 10% THC to be high potency.
High potency, right. That's for us, it's low potency.
For us, it's low potency. I think so anything over 10% based on European data is high potency. And the European data shows that anything over 10%, an adolescent may have an 11-fold increase of developing psychosis, an adult a 5-fold increase of developing psychosis. And the average smoked flower and bud in Colorado, for example, is about 20%. And then you get into the concentrates that are 50, 60%, and then the dabs, waxes, and shatters of the world that are 85% and beyond, some claiming 100% THC. And so those products are very dangerous. We are in uncharted waters. We don't know what the long-term sequela are going to be with these potent products. And as that industry has moved down that road, we are now seeing more and more people that are becoming psychotic. So there's a clear association in the U.S., for example, of increasing potency and increasing episodes of psychosis and violence.
What do you say to people say, you're just anti-marijuana, this is just reefer madness?
You know, I know I sound like a prohibitionist or a nihilist, but I'm not. I mean, I mentioned earlier in this podcast that I think from a basic science perspective, there's evidence of analgesic properties. You know, it does help or can help in certain areas. But I'm not. I mean, we can't blink our eye like Major What's-His-Face and put the genie back in the bottle anymore. It's here to stay. But now we need to put the guardrails and caps on to protect our patients and protect our communities.
Yeah. Oh, and the reason I like talking about it is I just want people to know to make informed decisions. You just need, you know, and then you could do what you want, but you need to be able to get the education and understand that's what's going on.
Well, that's exactly it. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, I actually published a paper a couple of years ago with a medical student from Denver for physicians to have these conversations with patients. And I actually ran it by the lawyers at the Colorado's largest malpractice carrier because I wanted it to be a kind of an informed consent. But I think we agreed being an informed consent would be probably not the best road. So we created an educational tool and kind of outlined things that physicians should talk to patients about. So for example, if your patient has a history of a heart attack 3 times, has been stented, has AFib on blood thinners, and wants to smoke marijuana, that is probably one of the worst patients you should encourage to smoke marijuana. So we counsel them, no, we do not use that. Or somebody who has had a major depressive episode or suicide attempt.
Or just explain the risk factor. Somehow it's easier with heart patients. It's like, this is a risk factor. You're on blood thinners. And if you use marijuana, it makes your blood thinner and you have a chance of increased chance of bleeding. Right. Or you have atrial fibrillation. If you're adding marijuana to it, you have more of a chance of, you know, worsening your cardiac arrhythmia.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because there are, you know, Robert Page, who's a pharmacist from Denver, who actually wrote part of my drug-drug interaction chapter in my book. He was also the lead author on the American Heart Association paper that demonstrate that cannabinoid receptor 1, CB1 receptor activation can lead to heart attack, arrhythmia, sudden death, and stroke. And so when you talk about arrhythmia and sudden death, those things will not be seen on autopsy, right? Mm-hmm. And we do have a case, Jelani Day from Chicago area, whose last known location was a marijuana dispensary in Chicago, was found in a river, drowned several days later, and he only had THC in his system, right? So it makes you wonder, and I actually had a conversation with the medical examiner And I said, do you think that his marijuana use could have been a contributing factor to this young man's drowning? Because the cause of death was drowning. And he said no. And I sent him all this information on cardiovascular risk. I said, well, what if they found opioids in his system? Well, that would have been a contributing factor. What about alcohol in his system? Well, that would have been a contributing factor. So even at the level of medical examiner coroners, they will not even consider THC a contributing factor in a person who's dead.
But your mind is altered, and that makes you do things that you're not as aware of, and you know.
Correct. Or could this young man have had a seizure? Because we know that cannabinoids can be pro-epileptogenic. They can precipitate seizure. You're not going to see that on an autopsy. They can also be pro-arrhythmic.
Interesting that they put buprenorphine as a contributing factor, but they won't put THC as a contributing. The thing is, there's no consistency.
Well, that's why we need to work with either at the state level or national level on having standards, because it's all over the map. Some places test, some places don't. And I think they should test everybody for everything. It all boils down to we don't have enough money. But like the state of Maryland, for example, will test Benadryl in death, but they will not test. THC is not on their radar to test at all. I think in Maryland, the only thing that they will test THC for is a driving fatality. But if you have a suicide or a murder, they'll test for Benadryl, but they won't test for THC.
Yeah.
That's a state level.
That's an opportunity for improvement. What about legalizing marijuana? I'm in California. It's legal. Colorado legal. Other places. What about federal legalization? What can federal government learn from the states that have legalized?
Well, number one, we haven't done a good job with the legal drugs we already have. You know, have we? I mean, tobacco kills hundreds of thousands of people a year. Alcohol, hundreds of thousands of people a year. Opioids, lots of people every single year. And now we simply have another addiction for addiction for profit industry, that the public health implications and harms are readily apparent. You know, so the feds need to understand that this is not going to bode well if they legalize. And you know, states that have
can they learn from it? Like, okay, but so all these other things are—that's the classic thing. Well, it's much better than alcohol, and we can argue whether it is or not. But can we learn from that? Like, okay, if you're going to legalize, then it has to be regulated without conflicts of interest to protect children, to make informed decisions, to have product integrity, these kind of things.
Right. That's pushing a boulder up a hill, a mountain, actually, because states like Colorado, California have already seen the implications of, quote, legal recreational marijuana. And it hasn't gone well.
Yeah, interesting. I was thinking that you can learn from that and at least regulate, collect the data, because it doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter if it's legal or not legal. I just want people to make informed decisions,
right?
And children to be protected.
Well, like in the state of Texas, for example, we had a friend whose 17-year-old son went to a smoke shop and purchased a hemp product. In that hemp product was Delta-9 THC and another cannabinoid called THCP, which is 30 times stronger. It has a 30 times stronger binding affinity to the CB1 receptor. And he was obtunded for 3.5 days. He didn't become violent, thank God, didn't commit suicide or murder or anything like that. He was just out of it. And interestingly, he had EKG changes in the emergency department, but he needed help to ambulate. He had to be catheterized because he couldn't pee, and he was only positive for THC. So I was very concerned, saying, hey, he was a minor. How come he wasn't, you know, carded or what have you? But in the state of Texas, there really are no age restrictions for hemp products, which are all THC products. So they take these things. So even a 10-year-old in the state of Texas can go to a smoke shop with $20 and buy marijuana gummies, quote, hemp gummies, that are basically modified to be THC analogs and isomers.
So there's a lot for the public to know about. What's your quick 1-2-liners about what the public should know?
Buyer beware.
That's a good one. That's a good one. Yeah. And if you had an elevator pitch with President Trump, what would your pitch be?
That's a really good question. Boy, Renee, you threw a curveball at me right there. if I had 2 seconds with him, I said, you need to find out what your shooter was on, because he took a shot at you. Country needs to know whether or not your assassin was involved with any other drugs. I mean, that's one thing I would say. And I, you know, as you know, I was one of the 25 of the 43,000 submissions to testify to the Department of Justice on rescheduling marijuana, and I was the only physician opposing it. It's not there yet. There's too many problems with product integrity, potency, that need to be ironed out before we consider rescheduling this. And if you're going to treat it as a medicine, treat it as a medicine. Put it through the rigors of FDA drug development protocols, which I support 100%. And we already have FDA-approved THC in the formulation of dronabinol, and FDA-approved...
He's already off the elevator.
He's already off the elevator.
Yeah.
I'm going to follow him, though.
But, yeah, interesting. I had that opportunity one time with a Governor Gray Davis at the time in the elevator, and I had to, like, you know, give my little spiel. Yeah, quick. All right, Dr. Ken Finn, thank you so much. Amazing work you're doing collating what should be public health data of gathering all the cases on the violent deaths and looking at the causes, and really for us to learn from. And for the public to be aware, I like your buyer beware.
Buyer beware.
Well, the other thing I like about you, just as I'm ending it, I'm adding one more thing. But I like the other thing that you say, that the brain is target number one and the heart is target number two.
Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Great. Good seeing you, Renee.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org. And ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.